The NCAA hands a punishment down to Penn State.
And huge rains and floods in Beijing. You can blame Mother Nature, but a lot of people are blaming the government there. I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York, in for Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Monday, July 23rd. We'll have more on the details of the Penn State penalty and a new round of economic troubles in Spain and the effect those are having on the markets.
And a little later in the podcast, we'll have a conversation with the guy who is sort of the top fraud cop for TARP. Everybody remembers TARP, although now we just call it the bailout. Well, it was his job to make sure that money was well spent, and he just wrote a book that suggests it was not very well spent. So it's an interesting conversation. That's coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
This morning, the NCAA announced the penalties it would impose on Penn State for the school's child sex abuse scandal. Here's NCAA President Mark Emmert.
No matter what we do here today, there is no action we can take that'll remove their pain and anguish.
The Penn State football team is barred from all bowl games for the next 4 years and faces a $60 million fine.
They've also had their number of scholarships cut by 40%, and all wins by the football team between 1998 and 2011 were vacated. Andrew Zimbalist is a sports economist at Smith College. Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Other schools have had scandals and been slapped by the NCAA. Put these penalties in perspective for me.
Well, the most serious penalty that's been given is to SMU. SMU was not allowed to play football at all for a year, and it essentially gutted their program. The NCAA has, on a number of occasions, imposed a postseason ban, a bowl game ban. So this is along those lines. It's not the most severe penalty. Of course, this penalty adds in the $60 million fee. Mm-hmm. But that money goes to supporting the other programs in athletics, and it goes to paying the ridiculously high coaches' salaries, and it goes to defraying some of the capital expenses of the athletics program.
How devastating is this going to be for State College, the town where Penn State is located?
Yeah, I think that State College has already taken a big hit just from the revelations about the program and Joe Paterno. Beyond that, in terms of the local economy of State College, most of the money that is spent at Penn State football games goes to the athletics department. It doesn't stay within State College.
I think people understand the handling of this was certainly bungled by the school to some degree, but it still boils down to the horrible actions of one man. How do you understand the severe penalties levied against the school itself?
Well, it's a little bit unusual for the NCAA to venture into this territory, but what does make sense to me is this notion of institutional control, that if a program accepts any kind of behavior so that the team will win, the NCAA really does have to step in and say, this is unacceptable.
Sports economist Andrew Zimbalist at Smith College, thanks very much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Overseas markets slid this morning on new worries about Spain. Joining us now to discuss is our own Stephen Beard in London. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Stacey.
Stephen, Spain just got a bank bailout on Friday. So what has got the markets upset this morning?
Well, the Spanish government and the European authorities were saying that once the Spanish banks had been bailed out, that would be it, the end of the crisis. It isn't. Investors are now worried that the Spanish central government itself is going to need a bailout too, because regional governments in Spain are in trouble. Valencia has asked for help, and on Sunday another region said it may need help too.
Is the Spanish government expected to ask its European partners or the International Monetary Fund for some financial help?
Spanish government borrowing costs suggest that they will. They hit 7.5% this morning, the level at which Portugal, Ireland and Greece all had to be bailed out. But Spain probably won't make the request immediately. After all, August is just around the corner. And as you know, Stacey, Europe goes on holiday in August. although, as Stephen Lewis of Monument Securities points out, markets won't be taking a vacation.
Well, I think the crisis will rage through August in the financial markets, but I don't think that the authorities in Europe will pay much attention to it during that month. Of course, that means that by the end of the month, we'll be facing a very serious situation indeed.
So September could be a really torrid month for the euro. And this is undermining confidence globally. If it were not for this debt crisis, we'd probably be getting more of a boost from the better economic picture in the US and the expectation that the current US earnings season will turn out quite well. But Europe, I'm afraid, once again, is dragging us all down.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Stacey.
And now let's turn to China, specifically the area around Beijing, where apparently 6 months' worth of rain fell over the weekend. The storm has reportedly killed 37 people. Almost 60,000 are out of their homes. And anger is reportedly shifting from Mother Nature to the government. Jeremy Goldkorn runs Danwei.com. It's a research firm that tracks media and internet activity in China. And he's with us from Beijing. Hello, Jeremy.
Good to be here.
Give me a sense of the scale of the damage.
Well, 37 people have died, according to official sources. And in the south part of the city, a number of houses and buildings have fallen over, in some cases killing people.
We're hearing some reports that Beijing infrastructure itself, the storm sewer system, maybe somehow contributed to the damage. Is that your impression as well?
Well, what the Chinese people are complaining about online is that although Beijing has had its share of really spectacular infrastructure projects that are easy to see, the projects that aren't easy to see aren't properly funded. So there's a lot of suspicion that sewerage and water drainage have been neglected in the city.
These would be the systems that would ordinarily funnel this water away to someplace safe.
That's correct. They were just overwhelmed by the quantity of water in a very short space of time. So I think the infrastructure just wasn't sufficiently advanced to cope with the amount of water.
Certainly people are frustrated. They're venting online. Would you expect much, if any, real political fallout from the situation?
Well, if one looks at previous examples, I mean, for example, the fatal train crash almost exactly a year ago today, there were a few officials who lost their jobs. There has not been a transparent, systematic investigation into the disaster. And that one was in some ways much bigger news than this one. The death toll was about the same. So I don't see any reason why it will be different this time.
Jeremy Goldkorn runs Danwei.com, which tracks media and internet activity in China. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The suspect in the Colorado theater massacre made his first court appearance this morning. James Holmes isn't talking to police, but he did leave behind a rich internet trail. Authorities say it shows how easy it was for him to buy lethal supplies. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that story.
The owner of a gun range in Colorado says James Holmes applied to join his club last month. Everybody who applies has to go to a mandatory orientation. But Glenn Rotkovich says he was taken aback when he called Holmes to invite him to the orientation.
I got this bizarre answering machine of his that was a very bass, guttural, growling, James type of thing going on.
Rotkovich decided not to let Holmes into the club, but no one stopped Holmes from ordering all kinds of combat supplies over the internet. Police say he received at least 50 packages in the months before the shooting, all stuff he ordered over the web. Police say Holmes bought 6,000 rounds of ammunition online, plus a combat vest, gas mask, and a knife. You usually have to buy guns in person because you have to pass a background check, but there are no checks when you want to buy gun supplies on the web, and there's no official system to track whether people are stockpiling ammunition and other lethal supplies. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The Troubled Assets Relief Program, or TARP, you might recall that was the formal name for what we often just called the bailout. In 2008, Congress allocated $700 billion to stabilize the U.S. financial industry.
Congress and President Bush assigned one man to build a team and police all of that spending for fraud. Until February, Neil Barofsky was the special inspector general for TARP. His book about the experience comes out tomorrow. It's called Bailout, an inside account of how Washington abandoned Main Street while rescuing Wall Street. For our Midday Extra today, we've got an in-depth conversation with Neil Barofsky. Good to talk with you.
Great to be here.
So, Neil, what was the job that you believed in your core you were appointed to do?
Well, essentially, that was set out by Congress when they created TARP. They created a special inspector general that was supposed to be the taxpayer's advocate in many ways, to look out for fraud, to make the necessary recommendations to Treasury, to help bring them in line so that the banks and participants in TARP wouldn't take advantage of loopholes or conflicts of interest, and at the same time go out and lock people up when they tried to steal from the program.
So when you got to the Treasury Department, from whom you were nominally supposed to be independent, what was the job that they seemed to want you to do?
Well, essentially, they wanted me to back down, I think, every time I started raising some concerns. The pushback I got was remarkable. I remember within the first couple of days, I started hearing a refrain that I heard over the course of a couple of years from Bush administration to the Obama administration saying, Neil, we hear what you're saying about your concerns about fraud and about potential abuses in this program, but really you don't have to worry about it because these are banks. They're not going to risk their reputation by taking unfair advantage and possibly profiting off of the taxpayer.
You write a lot about your disillusionment with the Home Affordable Modification Program. It's TARP money that was supposed to go to banks to help people stay in their homes. In your view, what happened to it?
Well, the program has been an abysmal failure. It's supposed to help up to 4 million people. Even today, it's about 20% of that number, and it doesn't look like it's going to get much better. We confronted Tim Geithner about this, and his response was very telling. It wasn't talking about how the program could be improved to help homeowners. He said that the program would help, and I quote here, foam the runway for the banks. And by that, he explained that the banks could deal with a certain number of millions of foreclosures over a certain period of time, but anything more than that could put the financial system and those banks in jeopardy. And with that in mind, there's little surprise that the program has been such a failure for everyone other than the large banks.
There are a lot of folks in Washington who would probably say you didn't play the game right. And if you had, you might have accomplished more. Can you look back and say that you actually accomplished anything in your role?
I think we had a tremendous amount of accomplishments. And I think when you look at the fraud losses for TARP, which are going to be historically far, far below anything that one would imagine for a program its size and scope, I think that probably is our most meaningful success. But you're right. I certainly didn't play the game. And, you know, at one point in 2010, I was told by the person who was running the TARP at the time that if I didn't change my tone, as he put it, that I was going to do great harm to myself and my ability to get a job on Wall Street or more plum appointment within the administration. That's a really dangerous precedent. Because of the revolving door between Washington and Wall Street, there's that incentive for all the regulators to pull their punches, play the game, and get their big payday at the end of the rainbow. And I think that's one of the fundamental problems that we need to change if we want to avoid having another financial crisis.
The former Special Inspector General for TARP, Neil Barofsky, his new book is Bailout. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, Jeff, do you have any travel plans this summer?
I have traveled quite enough going back and forth to Los Angeles to get out here for this job, so I'm gonna sit tight for a while.
Well, you may have noticed on your tickets a fuel surcharge. It sometimes gets tacked onto the price of your ticket.
Mm-hmm, I've seen it. Yep.
Well, as it turns out, that has a life of its own. A new survey from Carson Vaughan-Lee found that those surcharges are actually rising faster than the fuel costs themselves.
Huh.
The fees U.S. airlines charge us for fuel, so they've jumped more than 50% since last year. The actual fuel prices have risen less than half that.
What?
And okay. The survey found that most airlines don't reduce their fuel surcharges even when oil prices fall. Apparently, nowhere to go but up for fuel fees.
Apparently, it's not really a fuel surcharge. What is it? It's just for fun.
It's just a surcharge that can vaguely be tied to fuel. Maybe would be a better name for
it. Mysteries of the airline industry.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
The 19th International AIDS Conference is underway in Washington, D.C. As Elizabeth Wynn Johnson reports, we've reached a critical juncture in the AIDS fight.
The fight to end the AIDS pandemic has required decades of translating basic research into clinical breakthroughs. The rate of new HIV infections has leveled off, and just last week, the Food and Drug Administration approved the first HIV prevention pill, a pivotal moment for the International AIDS Conference to land in the nation's capital, says Chris Collins. He's vice president of AMFAR, the Foundation for AIDS Research.
We now have the tools to begin to end AIDS. And the question is, will we use them strategically? Will we invest appropriately to realize the potential of this moment?
Earlier this year, President Obama released a proposed budget that includes roughly a 10% reduction in U.S. funding for global HIV/AIDS programs. Just days ago, the administration announced plans to distribute $69 million to help states eliminate their growing wait lists for AIDS drug assistance programs. It's funding that had already been set aside for the cause. I'm Elizabeth Wynn Johnson for Marketplace.
So 1 year ago, Stacey, this law went into effect called the Plain Writing Act. And the idea is to compel or at least cajole, I don't know what kind of teeth this thing actually has, not much, I think, federal agencies into communicating with the public in a more accessible way. That makes sense.
Sounds like a good goal.
Yeah. Well, the other day, a nonprofit, the Center for Plain Language, came out with its first report card, which is based on the act. And on the whole, these results are not terribly difficult to understand. Most agencies are not doing very well. Annetta Cheek is the director of the Center for Plain Language. Annetta, good to have you here.
Yes, it's a pleasure to talk with you.
Give me one or a couple of your favorite examples of what is still quite wrong with writing in the U.S. federal government.
Well, I can refer you back to our WonderMark Awards, which we give out to organizations, including government agencies, that have just put out some truly terrible piece of communication. And 2 years ago, the grand winner was the I-94 form from the Department of Homeland Security, which is the form you get to fill out when you are coming into this country and you are not a citizen. You know, it starts out, welcome to the U.S., and then it has all of these questions implying that, you know, you're the worst offender in the universe.
Guilty until proven innocent, I guess.
Yes, exactly.
So it's not about the bureaucraties in that case. It's simply about uninviting language from government.
Well, yes. And that's part of plain language. And then, of course, there's all the IRS forms. Everybody gets those. Mm-hmm. But I must say that IRS is one of the agencies that's working hard to correct that problem. But they still have a lot of forms out there that they haven't gotten to that are still truly terrible.
And on your report card, which agencies are doing fairly well?
You will be able to find some good material from the Department of Agriculture. I don't want to overstate this. this is something that's going to take agencies a long time. They have so much material. They have so many people who have written the bureaucratic way for years and years. And it's not just writing, it's the viewpoint. Do the writers think about the reader's needs when they're writing? And in general, writers in a bureaucracy, particularly the government bureaucracy, do not think about the readers.
Annetta Cheek with the Center for Plain Language. Good to talk with you.
Okay, thanks so much.
Teach for America, the program that recruits recent college grads to work in underperforming schools, is making a push into the political arena. Former TFA grads, as they're known, have won seats in state houses and on local school boards. WPLN's Blake Farmer has more on one tight race in Nashville.
Teach for America has all the ingredients to become a political powerhouse. There are thousands of bright young college grads, often from elite universities, who can be tapped as campaign foot soldiers.
All right, let's get you all some shirts.
At a recent candidate forum, current and former Corps members pass out T-shirts supporting one of their own. Candidate John Hobenreich worked for TFA in Newark, New Jersey. He's now an attorney who sees public office as an extension of his time teaching high school English.
It's producing a generation of leaders who know what it's like to teach in an urban classroom like that.
Teach for America is encouraging its alums to run. In 2008, the organization spun off Leadership for Educational Equity. The separate nonprofit prepares former Corps members for public office, and it's had some success in the Colorado and Maryland state legislatures. Perhaps it was only a matter of time, but now Teach for America is fielding enough candidates that two have shown up in the same race.
As an official organization, they're having an interesting policy quandary as to what to do.
In a campaign to unseat Nashville's school board chair, Hobenreich is joined by Alyssa Kim, who taught in New Orleans. She stayed on with TFA and is now the chief recruiter. She's gotten fundraising help from her TFA colleagues, including the CEO herself, but she downplays the affiliation.
I think at the end of the day, right, like what I'm for are great schools.
Kim is not the first TFA employee to run for school board, but her day job does create a potential conflict. In the more than 40 cities where TFA works, school boards pay the organization to come to town. Kim says she has nothing to do with those contracts.
Regardless, I would recuse myself from any discussion or decision involving Teach for America, because Teach for America will stand on its own merits, or not.
So far, the local school system has been impressed with TFA, increasing the number of recruits it hires each year. But hiring more Teach for America alums for public office, that's up to the voters. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
And now, Jeff, E.T. finally can phone home without actually breaking the bank.
Okay.
There's a new art installation in Mexico City that offers free payphone calls to anywhere in the world.
Hmm. Just trying to get people to use payphones. Is that the idea, or what's the, is this? How's it art?
Brought to you by the Payphone Association of America,
maybe.
Or of Mexico.
Mexico.
It's part of an art installation, actually, by Minerva Cuevas. It's at the Museum of Mexico City. The phone includes instructions on how to dial any number in Mexico or the world, but and. Jeff, you probably are not going to be super surprised about this. The phone has been out of order.
Like most payphones that you might stumble across.
In the grand tradition of payphones being out of order and eating quarters.
Finally, this last item might also be performance art. Actually, we don't know. Only the goat man knows for sure. wildlife officials in northern Utah are worried about this guy, and they're calling him the goat man. Hikers have spotted this guy, and they take pictures of him. He in fur and a mask with antlers or horns or whatever a goat would have, a mountain goat. He's running on all fours with the mountain goat herds near Ogden, Utah. And nobody knows. Is he doing research? Is he just an extreme wildlife enthusiast? Apparently, he's not doing anything illegal, according to officials there. But they're a little bit worried about him, and not just, you know, mentally. Because, first of all, mountain goats are unpredictable creatures. And secondly, Utah goat hunting season is apparently right around the corner. So,
well, it might be in his interest to at least wear an orange vest when he's running around with a goat herd.
That's right. I guess he wants to blend in, but you don't want to blend in that much. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
From APM, American Public Media.